Blastomycosis is a potentially deadly infection that can result from inhaling a fungus that lives in disturbed dirt, and it's present in part of Wisconsin. Oh, hi, I'm Jill Nijow. One more thing to worry about, and this is the Larry Mueller Show. We're learning more about blastomycosis, also called blasto, from our guest, Bruce Klein. He's a professor of medical microbiology and immunology at UW-Madison. He oversees the Klein Laboratory, which focuses on fungal pathogenesis and immunology. Why can't I say that, Bruce? Why is that? Why can't I say that?
I don't know. It's probably easier to say that I'm also a professor of pediatrics
okay.
and medicine.
Okay, that sounds good. We can do that. What questions do you have about this disease? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Bruce, thanks you so much for being here. I should say Dr. Klein, but since we're talking about blasto, maybe Bruce is okay?
Bruce is fine.
Okay, thank you very much. So tell us, what is this?
So blastomycosis is a disease that derives from a fungus that lives in the environment, mm-hmm. typically soil or soil-like substrates. This is a fungus that has some unique features in terms of its lifestyle. It grows as a mold in the environment, as a what experts might call a soil saprophyte. It feeds off nutrients in the environment in a mold form. Mm-hmm. When the soil or soil substrate is disturbed, the organism can be inhaled into the lungs, which is the natural route of infection. And because of the change in the environment, typically the increase in temperature from ambient temperature to the temperature within a mammalian host, the organism, as a response to stress, undergoes a dramatic morphological change in its shape. It grows from a spore into a yeast, a large, thick-walled, armored yeast that helps endow it with pathogenic properties so it can survive within the lung environment, and also resist immune defenses by mammalian hosts.
Oh,
so
goodness.
It's a very effective pathogen.
Yeah, it sounds like something like a science fiction movie from the 50s. My goodness. I grew up in the UP, up in the northern part of the world here, and I had never heard of it before maybe 10 years ago. Is this something that that's fairly new that we've recognized, or has it just been around and we just haven't heard about it?
I think you probably haven't heard about it.
Okay.
It was initially discovered in the late 1900s by an investigator at Johns Hopkins who's credited
uh-huh.
with this, Gilchrist, who identified the organism in a dog. And so we've known about it for well over a century.
Mm-hmm.
I would say it's a relatively uncommon infection. However, just as the snow flies in Wisconsin and Michigan, we do see outbreaks every year or two, sometimes large, sometimes small. If you're in the Upper Peninsula, mm-hmm. you've probably heard about the outbreak a few years ago in Escanaba, which involved more than 100 people.
Right.
So it's a very large one,
yeah.
the largest one on record.
Right. And how did that, where did that come from? It's soil-borne, correct?
Generally speaking, it is, although... it's often difficult to know where the organism originated in a large outbreak. More times than not, in fact, almost always, when there's a so-called point source outbreak where everyone's exposed at the same location, experts rush to the site to try and figure out where it originated. To answer the question you asked, and 99 times out of 100, they can't find it. We've been successful in Wisconsin in a few instances that have helped clarify the ecological niche of the fungus. But as in Escanaba, where they searched and collect all kinds of samples from the environment, from HEPA filters inside, outside, from riverbanks, they came up empty-handed, unfortunately. And so they could only speculate where the origin was for that fungus.
So when I was doing a little background on this, I didn't realize that it takes a long time for this to actually, it's like 3 to 12 weeks after exposure for this to become a problem.
It can take a while. Mm-hmm. It probably depends a lot on the number of spores that are inhaled, the so-called inoculum mm-hmm. effect.
Okay.
It probably depends on the individual. Some individuals may be more prone, depending on their immune system, depending on their genetic makeup. We had the occasion to investigate a large outbreak in central Wisconsin a number of years ago, perhaps about 10 years ago. And we observed an unusual predisposition or overrepresentation of cases in the Hmong population. And after an extensive investigation of these individuals, we identified a genetic predisposition, a particular gene that rendered them more susceptible. So there are a number of factors that may have to do with the organism, its virulence, the dose inhaled, the host. This all may feed into why it may take shorter or longer to develop symptoms.
Is this something that's contagious from one person to another?
It's a really important question. I'm glad you asked. There's a good deal of misunderstanding, fear, and anxiety when someone contracts this infection that it could be contagious. But it is not, and I would underscore that point, it is not contagious mm-hmm. from one person to another. And the reason for that is that the infectious form of the organism is the spore. The spore is very small and believed to be small enough to be inhaled into the airways. And when it infects an individual, as I mentioned before, it usually changes into a much larger yeast form. And it's believed that those large yeasts are too large to be inhaled and transmitted to another individual. Now, there are some rare, exceedingly rare exceptions. For example, this infection is probably more common in animals, particularly dogs, because they have their nose close to the ground. And in some parts of the state of Wisconsin where this disease has very high rates, and probably the highest in the world, the rate of infection in dogs may be as high as 1 to 2% of the population of animals, and probably 10 to 100 times higher than the rate of infection in people. Dogs that get infected, if they were to be shedding the organism in their saliva and directly inoculated into the hands of a vet, for example, with a bite, that could create what might be called a cutaneous inoculation, an inoculation directly into the skin. Mm-hmm. Or if somebody is, for example, using a hypodermic needle to aspirate an infection in the skin of an animal and then accidentally stabs themselves or nicks themselves through the skin, that can be a source of direct introduction mm-hmm. through the skin, an unnatural route, an uncommon, but occasionally it can happen.
Okay. So with people, what kind of symptoms are we looking at?
Right. So in people who are symptomatic, not everybody is symptomatic.
Okay.
But in individuals who develop symptoms, the most common symptoms are a respiratory infection. So you might not be able to distinguish it from a bad chest cold, for example. This infection, should it get down into your chest and continue to progress, will cause pneumonia. And so one can become sicker with quite a bit of coughing. In an acute form, there can be a high temperature and shaking chills. So I guess the bottom line is it can be hard to distinguish this infection from other causes of pneumonia and a really bad chest cold. So that's in an acute form. we often see probably a higher proportion of cases that are more chronic infections, a so-called walking pneumonia, if you will. And in those cases, you can see it go on for weeks, sometimes even months. People will have periodic temperature, they'll have a cold, but it, you know, it may be a walking pneumonia. They may lose weight. Sometimes people can lose 10 to 20 pounds with this kind of a walking pneumonia. And so the most important thing is that physicians who see patients like this need to have a high index of suspicion or concern because it's a less common form of pneumonia.
And this is more likely to be found in the northern part of this of our state, number one, and in what, in the woods, basically. Is that right? Or is it just not necessarily the woods?
You know, people who get out into the woods are going to be exposed to soil mm-hmm. that may be contaminated with the fungus. You know, we found through studies years ago with the Wisconsin Division of Health that the organism seems to like moist, rich soil that one can find along riverbanks and riverways. And so it's not uncommon, and there have been famous outbreaks of infection along Wisconsin waterways. For example, the Nemecogon River, the Little Wolf River, the Plover River, the Eagle River chain of lakes. And so, you know, exposure along riverbanks, fishing, canoeing, boating, all these kinds of activities that Wisconsinites and even folks from other nearby states seem to enjoy are potential risk factors. But I would underscore it's an uncommon infection.
It is uncommon, but it's out there, so you should be aware of it.
It is out there.
We are talking about blastomycosis with Bruce Klein, a professor of medical microbiology and immunology at UW-Madison. He oversees the Klein Laboratory and focuses on fungal pathogenesis and immunology. And you can join the conversation. Just give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Vilna Joe, tomorrow on the show, we're going to take a look at a new documentary about the Bay of Green Bay. We're going to chat about insects with Phil Pelletieri. And then finally, we're going to talk turkey about the spring turkey hunt. So hopefully you can join us. Right now, we are talking about blasto. And we've got a bunch of calls coming in, so we'll get to those as soon as we can. Right now, we're talking with Bruce Klein. Bruce, we had mentioned about people getting the disease, but we'd also mentioned about dogs getting the disease. Now, that can be a little bit more deadly, should I say, for dogs. Am I right in that?
You're correct. Mm-hmm. The fatality rate in dogs is considerably higher than it is in people. In people who are otherwise healthy, the cure rates are very, very high, better than 90% mm-hmm. in people who are treated, diagnosed and treated correctly. In dogs, for various reasons, the fatality rate may approach 50%. And that probably has to do with difficulties in diagnosis in dogs. So the infection is usually progressed to a more invasive state that may have spread from outside the lung, from within the lungs to outside the lungs mm-hmm. to other body parts. It may also have to do with considerable cost of care. It can cost thousands of dollars to treat a dog with this infection. And so people may not have insurance and may choose to forego treatment. So there are various reasons for why dogs have a higher fatality rate, unfortunately.
Yeah. Speaking of treatment, we've got Lee and Phillips with a question about that. Go ahead, Lee.
Yeah, I was wondering what the best way to treat blastomycosis is.
Hi, Lee. There's a very effective treatment for blastomycosis in its usual form, that is pneumonia in a previously healthy individual who has mild to moderate infection that's restricted to the lung. There's an oral medication An oral antifungal medication that's commonly used to treat fungal infections, and it's very effective, usually much better than 90% effective for treating such cases. So the treatment just has to be continued for a while, typically for at least 6 months, which is a longer course of antibiotic, we'll say, than people are usually used to taking. But under those circumstances, the cure rates are very high.
How's it tested for?
Yeah, that can be a challenge. So as I mentioned, the most important way to diagnosis is to have a very high index of suspicion for physicians around the state. And fortunately, doctors around the state are very knowledgeable about this and do think of it. And the Division of Health has done a great job in educating the public. But nevertheless, it can be a challenging diagnosis to make. If someone has pneumonia or a really bad chest cold, you can often find the organism within the expectorated sputum. So when people are sick, they're often coughing, and that material is often positive for the fungus. It can be cultured. It can also be seen under the microscope quite often. There are blood tests that can also be done looking for antibody, evidence that the immune system has responded to the fungus. And then there are newer tests called antigen tests, where the fungus sheds some of its sort of cell wall, if you will, and those products get into the bloodstream and they get shed into the urine. They get cleared within the urine. And the urine sample usually yields a positive result within about 75 to 90 plus percent of the time, depending on the form and progression of the illness. Those tests together, the expectorated sputum and the urine and the blood, are often used in combination, and they're frequently positive. So one can diagnose it if one thinks about it.
Once you're looking for it, you're mm-hmm. good. And then once treated, is there any lasting effects?
The lasting effects, depending on the form, can be significant. So, for example, if somebody has a very severe and progressive infection in the lungs, we can see this in some instances. There can be long-term damage mm-hmm. within the lung, and those are the most severe cases. Sometimes, as I mentioned, the infection can spread outside the lungs, so including, in rare instances, to the brain. And so there can be injury to different parts of the brain and neurologic sequelae mm-hmm. as a result. Blastomycosis effectively can spread to any organ in the body if it progresses undiagnosed. And so there can be consequences depending on the organ. But, you know, those are fortunately less frequent okay. complications.
Well, let's go to Scott in Wausau, who may be able to comment on that. Go ahead, Scott.
Hi. Interesting topic. I'm a blastomycosis survivor. I had blasto about 16 years ago, and I lived in a subdivision in the Wausau area at that time that was under heavy construction. And I think just from the disturbance of the soil, which is very sandy and acidic, that must have been where the spores came from, because my neighbor's dog, who never left the yard, also had blastomycosis at that time. It's pretty devastating. I was out of work for a month, and that was categorized at the time as a very mild case of blastomycosis. And I know several others in the neighborhood also had blasto. So fortunately, although misdiagnosed as pneumonia, a heightened awareness by the staff at the hospitals helped with the diagnosis.
Okay, thank you, Scott. Appreciate you sharing that with us. There again, it's kind of prime area of Wisconsin, in that area.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you got over it. That's great news. One of the really unusual and interesting features, about blastomycosis is dogs can often be a harbinger of disease in individuals that are in the same area. So sometimes, you know, if you take a careful history, for example, people that may vacation up north who present to their doctor with a bad chest cold or pneumonia may report to an astute physician who asks the right questions, have you ever had any animals in the home contract a bad infection and die, perhaps? And families may say, oh, yes, we did have a dog that died of blastomycosis. And that's an immediate tip-off that you may be dealing with something like that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Scott. So what should we be thinking about as a precaution with knowing that this is about? Are there things that we should be avoiding or that we can do?
Sure. Well, I would encourage people to enjoy the state of Wisconsin and everything that it has to offer because it's an uncommon infection. If you're healthy, if for some reason you have compromised immunity, you may be more vulnerable mm-hmm. to these kinds of infections. And so I think, you know, avoiding risk factors, I would encourage people to talk with their primary physician about what kinds of things might pose risk. Hunting, fishing, boating, you know, being close to construction. And if one enjoys those activities and chooses to participate, taking appropriate precautions, for example, a mask, a good mask. For example, if the individual has compromised immunity, but nevertheless, you know, wants to participate, I would say an N95 mask that could filter out particulates. Those would be the most important things. And as I say, the other thing is to have a high index of concern. If you're participating in activities like that and you get sick three to 12 weeks later and you have a bad chest cold or pneumonia and your doctor has treated you with one or two or three courses of antibiotics and you're not getting better, you might suggest, well, what about this less common infection due to a fungus?
Mm-hmm. Heidi in Eagle River emailed to say that she's very familiar with Blasto in Eagle River, Wisconsin. People believe that the closer you are to the Wisconsin River, the greater the chances of finding Blasto. She has known people who've had it and survived. However, if a dog gets it, chances of survival appears to decrease. She never lets her dogs dig in the dirt. And when she works with dirt, wood chips, gardening, etc., she always wears a mask. And William emailed to say that he spends summers canoeing on the Red River near the Little Wolf, right in the heart of Blasto country, and he asks, would wearing an N95 mask help? So I think we just said that it probably would.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Another listener called but couldn't stay with us, and he asked if there are higher concentrations of this fungus in or near beaver dams. That's an interesting question.
Right. When I first came to Wisconsin, I was stationed here to work at the Division of Health. And shortly after I arrived, they asked me to establish a program looking at distribution of the infection, rates of the infection, and to become the local expert within the division. And late in that interval, we had the unusual occurrence of a very large outbreak, the largest outbreak on record in Wisconsin at that point in time, of close to 60 cases. And what happened was there were numerous calls coming in sequentially to the Division of Health about young children from different parts of the state who were falling ill with this somewhat uncommon infection. And they asked me to explore it, and quickly we learned it was blastomycosis. And after an extensive investigation promulgated by the Wisconsin Division of Health, really the outstanding Wisconsin Division of Health, who had then invited the CDC in to help investigate the epidemic. Together, we learned that individuals had traveled to Eagle River to learn about the environment. Various school groups from all over the state had gone there to a very famous camp where kids learn about the environment. And they had introduced a new activity, a really exciting new activity, learning about beaver ecology.
Oh, no.
And so you can imagine young children traipsing around and on to a beaver dam. And fifth and sixth graders all jumping up and down, yelling and screaming and throwing dirt. And sure enough, 3 to 12 weeks after that exposure, they began to fall ill. In that instance, we had the good fortune of isolating the organism from the environment on top of the beaver lodge and then from the beaver dam, working closely with investigators from the CDC and also the South Carolina Bureau of Laboratories. And so we learned quite a lot about the ecology. When we published this, they referred to an editorial called Leave It to Beaver.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that story. That's a great one. And for being with us and explaining this. We really appreciate it. We've been talking with Bruce Klein, professor of medical microbiology and immunology at UW-Manis. Thank you for very, very much for listening. And we'll see if Larry's feeling better tomorrow. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thank you for being with us.